From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Fiona McCrae, director and publisher of the Minneapolis-based Grey Wolf Press. Grey Wolf Press is an independent publisher committed to the discovery and publication of 21st century American and international literature. This is from their website. Grey Wolf champions outstanding writers at all stages of their careers to ensure that adventurous readers can find underrepresented and diverse voices in a crowded marketplace. Founded in 1974 in Port Townsend, Washington, by Scott Walker, Grey Wolf's first publications were limited edition chapbooks of poetry, which were printed on a letterpress and hand-sewn by Walker and his colleagues. Grey Wolf was incorporated as a nonprofit in 1984. Today, the press remains dedicated to publishing poetry, and their lists have expanded to include fiction and nonfiction as well. Grey Wolf publishes 30 to 35 books each year by authors at all stages of their careers, from the United States and around the world. Their books and authors have received significant national and international awards, including the Nobel Prize for Literature, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, the Man Booker Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the National Book Award. Fiona McCrae has been publisher of Grey Wolf since 1994, following 11 years with the British publishers Faber & Faber, of which the last 3 years were spent in Faber's office in Boston. Authors that Fiona has published at Grey Wolf include Elizabeth Alexander, Charles Baxter, Per Pettersson, Salvatore Scavone, and Percival Everett. She currently serves on the boards of the National Book Foundation and the Anderson Center. Fiona McCrae received the Editor's Award from Poets and Writers in 2017 and the Golden Colophon Award for Leadership from the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses in 2014. When I spoke with Fiona, I asked if we could begin by talking about Grey Wolf and its mission. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
We are an independent, non-profit literary publisher, and I imagine all those words are important to sort of fully understand when you think about Grey Wolf.
Yeah.
And we publish about 30 or so books a year, and the idea is that they're either the type of author or the type of genre or the type of individual work within those categories that might be, in inverted commas, commercially challenged in some way. So that they either would be not published or perhaps not published well by the larger houses. So we're trying to make a virtue out of maybe some of the challenges of publishing poetry and essays and translation and voices from underrepresented communities or historically underrepresented communities, all those things.
Right.
And we publish... The list of 30 is divided fairly equally between fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. We have a contemporary emphasis, and that really flows from the fact that we're going to publish new writers because we are nonprofit, and I feel that that is a good use of nonprofit dollars to go to books and authors who are do not yet have an audience. So I could imagine, for example, you could be nonprofit and publish cheap editions of Jane Austen or Dickens or something like that.
Right.
But my mission, our mission, my view of our mission, put it like that, is that it's our duty, our responsibility to try and find the new work that is struggling to come into existence. And because of that, our writers are living, and because of that, I'm interested in the ones who are trying to make sense of the current moment of our times. So there's less emphasis on historical fiction on our list, you'll see. And we're also interested in work that is really engaged with the world in some way, not overly detached, not too insular. But all the time, across the list, we're looking for work that is singular. We use that as a kind of benchmark word when we're wondering whether to take something on. It's like, does this sound like anything else? If it sounds like five other writers, I'm not so interested. So we end up sometimes with hybrid work, with work that's hard to define, that kind of thing on the list.
Does hard to define make it hard to sell? I'm curious.
Yes. All those things make it hard to sell. However, I think we're slightly changing some of the successes on the Grey Wolf list, the sort of challenging ideas about what is sellable and what isn't in the marketplace. Mm. And we had big success with Claudia Rankine's Citizen, for example, that was very hybrid and didn't look like anything else and is one of our all-time best-selling titles. Now it's sort of over 300,000 copies sold. And some of our essays, which used to be, essays used to be such a sort of turn-off word, have sold very well, so that I have a joke with one of our essayists, Eula Biss, that we gentrified the neighborhood of the essay. So we've made the whole, well, we've contributed to the whole genre of the essay being more successful. So now we sometimes lose not only our individual authors after they've had a sort of bit of success on our list, but also we can't buy new authors. So that genre is being slightly redefined. But what is interesting, to go back to your question, is that over the last 5 years, we found that when we publish something to ourselves thinking, well, this is maybe less challenging to read, this is more straightforward, so this might have a bit more commercial potential, those are the books that we struggle to sell. Mm. Because those are the books sometimes that maybe the larger houses are selling better than we are, or people don't expect those kinds of books from Grey Wolf. But the odder, the more challenging, the more difficult the books look to us, the better they are doing.
Interesting. Wow.
Yes. And we're having, there's a really, the new generation of poets are really exciting these days. We're having books sell over 20,000 copies of poetry. And I think this is something that's a little bit across the board, but we're definitely seeing it on our list. And we're seeing a couple of agents starting to come into poetry, whereas they didn't used to. So it's a very interesting time where traditional notions of what sells and what doesn't sell, I think, are being challenged across the board.
And you've been at Grey Wolf for long enough to see this change, you know, really kind of the arc of it. That must be really kind of exciting, right?
It's very exciting, and that's the consolation, isn't it, of aging, is the perspective that you get when you look back. Grey Wolf has been very lucky over the last 5 to 10 years with awards nationally, internationally, and so we've had people walk in, and on their first day, Grey Wolf wins a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
And we tease them and say, you know, some of us were here 13, 15 years before this happened. So they think, oh yes, that's right, that happens once a week. I get it. So, but it's been interesting, and those of us who've been around a long time have the role of reminding everybody not to expect it to, you know, repeat into the future endlessly.
Certainly not to take it for granted, I'm sure.
Not to take it for granted, exactly. Yes.
Now, how do most of your authors make their way to Grey Wolf?
I would say there's different routes. The prose, which is, as I said, nonfiction and fiction, a high percent of that comes through agents, and the agents know us because they've worked with us before, or we've visited them and we've told them what we're looking for. They see what books are on the list, and they remind them of something maybe that they've got, and so they send it to us. A lot of the well-informed agents know that we might open the door to something that another person may not. So we are seeing a lot of quality submissions coming in from agents. Mm-hmm. We don't always get those ones, though, because they can sometimes be competitive. Sometimes the larger houses do come through, and we find ourselves outbid. Our authors recommend other writers to us, and that's always a nice grapevine that we recently took on a Native American writer who was recommended to us by another prose writer who had been his teacher. So that was very nice. Mm-hmm. We derive the nonfiction prize through an open submission process. So that those writers can come in without an agent, and sometimes they win the prize and then get the agent afterwards.
Right.
But that's been a really a nice way to advertise to writers with new manuscripts that we're looking, and they don't have to necessarily have an agent. And we just have finished going through the selection process. We're just finishing it up, and we've got about 4 shortlists. We might end up publishing someone who was shortlisted but didn't win nevertheless. So that's been an important source. And then also on the prose side, we go to the London Book Fair and the Frankfurt Book Fair every year,
mm-hmm.
when we can travel.
Yeah, when they hold it.
Yes, exactly. When we speak to editors from all over the world and rights directors who are selling the subsidiary rights onto other publishers in different countries. And that's been a very exciting thing to see grow our international list, both of British writers and other writers for whom English is their first language, and then also our translation list that's been growing.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethan Nisowski, one of my colleague editors, he's been going to the Guadalajara Book Fair, so some more Spanish language Latinx writers are coming onto the list through that way.
Hmm.
And that's been very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the poets, despite what I said about some agents starting to get into poetry, on the whole, that's not an agented process. So we have the Walt Whitman Prize to find a first book, which prevents us from getting inundated with manuscripts which cannot really be read properly. We can't really process that properly.
Yeah.
And then we have 2 poetry editors, and they kind of survey the scene. They survey magazines. They're in touch with poets. They follow up and reach out to people and say, "I'm interested in your work." And then sometimes the conversation can go on 3 to 5, 7 years before a manuscript arrives. And then again, word of mouth through the network of authors recommending other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very nice process.
Yeah.
One of the things we've been struggling with in recent years, or trying to juggle, is going back to this idea that I've been at Grey Wolf for a time and seen it develop. So when I arrived, they were down to, 6-8 books a year that year that I arrived. They mm-hmm. were retrenching financially. And then we got funding, and we sort of kept opening up the list and growing it and growing it, 12 books a year, 16 books a year, 20 books a year. And then when we started to hit around 30, 32, we were going to outgrow our office. We were going to outgrow our capacity to give individual attention to various books. So we felt, well, this is the right size. So then you've got a limited number of slots. You have to have keep some open for the new writers,
right.
But also the whole idea when you take on a writer is that they will want to publish with you again, and you want to build up a stable of writers. So that's been an interesting tension.
Yeah,
to keep those slots open for new work, and in any catalogue, there's maybe only 2 or 3 most out of 10 who are brand new to the list. So it's not a very wide opening, but at least it's something. And what we found is that tendency that I was talking about earlier, that some on the prose side, there have been some writers who have been offered more money for their second or third books, and they have chosen that path. And we have absolutely no complaints about that. We understand why.
Often, sure.
What we call life-changing money. They're not leaving just for an extra $10,000 or something. It's really
right.
a lot of money in
right.
a lot of cases. So that actually is very, it's painful and sad in some ways, but it opens up the list for us to go back and find somebody.
Right. I was
second book stage.
I was thinking that you probably, you know, if you don't have a contract for a subsequent book, but you know that the author's working on something, and so you sort of have that in the back of your mind that it may be coming to you at some point, that's challenging, I'm sure, to figure out how much to set that slot aside for that person who you perhaps have a lot of respect for or anticipation
right.
of. Yeah, yeah. And I would think that your prize winners, you sort of want to hang on to. So.
That's right. That's right. But those, and sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. So it depends on the case. And one of the things that I like least is when you're publishing a book by somebody and it's doing well, and then the agent chooses that moment to sell the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're in the middle of publishing somebody and then and simultaneously losing them. That can be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that does happen, and sometimes it's to do with timing. So we always respect what our writers do. And many of them, if they do leave, they stay connected and helpful and in conversation with us.
Yeah. Well, that actually brings me to, I was going to say, I think of you as having one of the best jobs, maybe not when we're in the middle of a pandemic, but it feels to me like your job would be awesome. But one of the questions I was going to ask is, what do you sort of most look forward to about your job, and what do you maybe most dread? And I'm thinking it must be really hard to watch the authors, that move on, even though that's probably, you're happy for their career.
Yeah.
But
As I say, it ends up being fine because it means that it keeps the list open.
Yes.
So, and I went into this position knowing that this was likely to happen and just deciding not to resent it somehow.
Right.
And as I say, sometimes it can be hard on the day or the week, and as I said, it can be hard if you're in the middle of publishing somebody, and they go off, and then you don't know what's happening on the. They're being shopped around, and you don't know what's happening when, for the book that you're publishing, you're sharing everything with the author and the agent. It's very much a collaboration, and suddenly you're plunged into the darkness, not knowing who or what is happening. And obviously, the editors and myself do, and the whole staff do get involved with certain people. But really, it balances out. We were able to keep Maggie Nelson and Claudia Rankin, mm-hmm. two writers who've done really well with us. We've been able to secure their next books, and so that felt very important to us. And there's a sort of still a stable of writers who seem to come back to Grey Wolf, J. Robert Lennon, Percival Everett. Mm-hmm. We seem to have become Deb Olin Unferth's publisher. And somebody like Leslie Jameson, mm-hmm. Who went off for her next book, she's stayed very open and connected to us. Wayeti Moore is leaving us for her next book, but we are doing two. We're doing two books by her. Her second book is about to come out.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's just out. So that gives us a run with somebody. Sometimes we publish one or two, and then the poets stay. So somehow it works. I sometimes think of publishing as impossible when you look at it on paper.
Yeah.
Like, this is not going to work. How does this work? But then it does. Maybe we lose two or three auctions in a row, and you think, when are we going to get the next book? And then something comes along and we get it and say, oh, there we are. And if we had got all four, our list would be too full.
Right, right.
So you end up being very happy with the ones that you do have. And I sort of think of sort of the image of a fountain with sort of the water at the top sort of falling away. You travel up, and then you need the water to fall away for the next droplets to come up, so to speak. So
yeah, that's a great image for it.
Yeah. So it's a way that it keeps the list dynamic. So it's not all about that.
Yeah. You mentioned Claudia Rankin, and I have a question that I'd like to ask you. But first, I'd like to read an excerpt from an essay that actually, I think I found this essay through you, having posted it somewhere. Do you mind if I do that, and then we can talk for a minute?
No.
Grey Wolf's offices are in Minneapolis, and your authors do represent diverse communities. This is an excerpt from an essay that was in Lit Hub. Minneapolis is a world-class literary hub. And then later, the author writes, you can't throw a rock without gently tapping a brilliant and inspiring BIPOC, LGBTQIA, white ally, writer, artist, musician, dancer, elder, educator, arts administrator, filmmaker, scholar, curator, grassroots activist, healer, hospitality worker, civil servant, and social justice warrior, or sometimes a combination of those. Now, this is an essay by Sue Huang, who's a poet and activist in Minnesota. And she goes on to say, Minnesota has a very dark, sinister side as well. And as the fact that Gray Wolf is in Minnesota, is in Minneapolis, I just wonder if we can talk about what this period has been like for the press, and also some of the authors who best meet the present moment, some of the Gray Wolf books that best meet the present moment.
Yes, that's a good question. It's been a great shock, obviously, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Personally, it's the neighborhood just adjacent to ours, one that we're always driving through and stop in, where a lot of the violence around that third precinct was, and we knew the area where the shooting was very well. And so that this amount of violence and that brutal police murder happened in our backyard sort of definitely, you know, shook us to the quick. And you feel all the mix of shame and confusion, and then a certain kind of pride in the uprising and possible exhilaration if things are going to change. So we're feeling all that, and having that, seeing that affect the staff, and thinking about the people who had, you know, the younger people who had chosen to move here, the younger people who'd only ever lived here, and then some of us who'd chosen to make our homes here, sort of what that meant. And I think the sinister side, or the divided side of Minneapolis, can be not so visible as you're going around. So it was possible to live here and feel that you were in a more sort of liberal place where there wasn't so much division, but there has been coverage about the divisions recently. So it was on our consciousness also. So it has been a difficult period, but I think people are set for some real change, and to see it echoing out across the country and realizing it's a local and simultaneously national, even global story. You know, absolutely not to point fingers away from here, but I've got some messages from British friends, and it was interesting that they feel that they're outside the problems of racism. I thought, well, actually, read the history books.
Yeah.
We're all linked. This is a 400-year story.
Yes.
And interestingly, I know I just said we don't have so much historical. It's making me question whether we shouldn't open our door a little bit more to some of that history.
Right.
To look at that, which in fact was one of our exceptions a while back. We published Song of the Shank by Jeffrey Renard Allen, about based on a real life story of a blind, possibly autistic pianist who ended up being a classical pianist, but he had been born into slavery. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Big times, and it hasn't actually made us feel that we need to change our mission. Going back to some of our writers, and there was a moment during all this when everybody was feeling low, obviously.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And we happened to have a launch meeting on this on the calendar. Sorry, and so some of us in the management team were thinking, shall we have this meeting? Shall we keep going with it or not? And we thought, yes, let's have it. There were other things that we can, it was going to be difficult to cancel it. And so we went ahead with the launch meeting, and it was an uplifting experience, because we could see how many of the books resonated with ideas and themes that were being talked about.
Yes.
And obviously you need to do things as an individual, but as Gray Wolf, part of our response is these books. It's not where do I go for my activism, where do I go for my work? There can be a link. There can be an overlap. It's not everything, and just publishing a book is not enough, but it was encouraging to see that. And we have Just Us coming in the fall, which is Claudia Rankine's next book, and it's called, the subtitle is, so anyway, it's called Just Us, : An American Conversation. And it's really looking at whiteness. It follows on from her book Citizen, and then her play, The White Card, and then moves to Just Us, where she's trying to, it's a sort of subtitle could have been Staying in the Room, Staying in the Conversation, something like that, because she's trying to challenge white people, sometimes decades old friends, you know, friendship, whether the other person is white, a white woman, for example,
yes,
or white men who she only has just met because she's traveling first class with them. And she's trying to get them to look at their privilege and talk to her about it and keep the conversation going. And she has an openness. She's not trying to catch people out, but she's interested in that gap and how to bridge it. And one of the things I've been saying, talking about that book, is that she doesn't want the solution to be we're all the same. She thinks that's not helpful, the e pluribus unum or whatever, but that it's better to acknowledge the differences, but at the same time, acknowledge that we're connected. You know, she makes us all responsible. We're all responsible for Trump, all of us. You can't divide yourself. You can't dissociate yourself in that sense. You know, we're all responsible for the society that we live in. So that's going to be very interesting to see how that book plays out, particularly in certain sense to white readers and to who maybe need to be nudged. You know, including me, including all of us white people. I don't want to say I'm outside of these problems.
No, I feel like we all have a long history of feeling like we're good people and not looking any harder at ourselves.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we've got a work by Jacob Guanzman, who's a Filipino writer, next year coming, called Abundance, which is really about poverty and about being at the sides and about the effects of incarceration. It's not headlines. Those are not the headlines of the book, as it were. It's a family story. It's a father and a son.
Uh-huh.
But behind it, that's the backdrop. And the chapter headings are how much money he's got left in his pocket. And it gets very dire as he's running out. He's trying to get this job and his son is getting sick.
Oh,
and
God.
One thing leads to another because you're in a novel. So that feels very important.
Yes.
Earlier this year, we published Homie by Dennis Smith. And they live right here in Minneapolis. And they won the Forward Prize for their previous book in England. And it got a lot of attention here. And it's very much about the African-American experience in many ways, and their friends and their friendships and their struggles. And that book was launching just as we went into the pandemic. So we were able to have some great events around that book. And it's been great to see Dinesh responding locally. They set up a Venmo account and they were running around town helping out, which was really inspiring.
Yeah. Now, when did you realize publishing a diverse group of authors would be a hallmark of Grey Wolf Press? Because this is a long time established tradition for you.
Yes. I don't think that it's sort of a moment.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it the other day, that when I joined in 1991, when I think back to some of the first writers I took on, there was quite a lot of diversity among that, with Percival Everett and Vijay Seshadri and Carl Phillips and David Troyer among some of my first acquisitions. But I wasn't scoring that so much at the time, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And although I was encouraged that I was interested in the ways in which they were not, not in the, maybe the dominant culture, or they were sort of had their own stories or something like that. But I think going back to a sense that we're publishing books outside the mainstream in some way, either by genre or by voice or whatever, I think we're interested in the narratives that are not the dominant ones. We're interested in people who are outside the dominant culture.
Right, sure.
And in a certain sense, that could be because you're Norwegian, and there's very few, at that time when we published Per Pedersen, not very much Norwegian fiction in America. Or it could be because you're African American, or it could be because you write poetry, whatever. But whatever it is that puts you in the margins is, I think, the thing that makes you interesting.
Mm-hmm. Was Out Stealing Horses a Grey Wolf book?
Yes.
Oh, I forgot that. I've just reread that. I love that book so much.
Oh, good. Yes, that was 2007, and that sort of helped to open the door, I think, to Grey Wolf and put us up a notch.
Yeah.
But I think what I'm interested in is contemporary work that reflects the world. And if I read a book that is entirely filled with white characters who are living in a world that is not threatened by global warming, I don't see how that book can be wholly interesting, wholly mm-hmm. artistically successful as a book that reflects our times.
Mm-hmm.
I want the whole swath in there. That's what I feel like I'm always looking for. And last year we published a book called White Flights by white writer and scholar Jess Rowe, and he's writing about the way race does and doesn't appear in various white writers' books, and sort of saying they set the fiction in Maine so that they won't find any, they won't have to have any black characters. Or there's some writers who he sort of shows how there's a little aside where there's some little glimmer of race, and it's so oddly treated. And then he talks about other ones who integrated in. So I just think that's where the interest is.
Yeah.
You know, that we're living in a mixed society. But I think it's hard to get the full picture. And on the other side, you don't want to go down a path of dividing your audience and saying, black readers only read black writers and white readers only read white writers. You want white readers to be reading black writers, which they are now more consciously across the population as a whole suddenly realize they need to do. And obviously, there always were some of our readers, obviously, well, a high percentage of our readers are white. So, but sort of getting those cross currents going seems to me to be interesting. And another thing, to go back to that question, was really a long time, maybe 20 odd years ago, Caveh Kanem, the African American poetry organization, mm-hmm. came to us and said, would we be interested in publishing the winner of their prize? And we ended up publishing the winner once every 3 years. And what interested me about that was that with those sort of white editorial staff, if you have an African-American organization and individuals who are picking, then you're actually sharing the editorial choice outside your own group, and maybe that would spread the net further. And that has led to, that led to Natasha Trethewey on our list, who subsequently left us, but we published her first couple of books. It gave us Tracy K. Smith, more recently Malcolm Tariq and Donika Kelly, and the generation of poets that have, were discovered by Kaveh Khanum have been so influential on the Grey Wolf list and on other lists. So I really credit them for being part of really bringing along a generation of Black poets who've been so dynamic and exciting and changing everybody, really. And then I think once, after we published Citizen, I think, to expand the question about the moment when we realized, I think there was a while when we were going along thinking that we were doing great on diversity because our list was diverse. But we stopped there. We always were trying to find board members of color and so on. But we really decided that it was time to redouble those efforts and to try and diversify the staff. And 2-3 years ago, we started something called the Citizen Literary Initiative. And that was sort of named after, obviously, the book
Claudia's
Citizen,
book.
And it's, yes, and it's about, on one bullet point in the program is to keep that book selling and finding ways to give it away. But it's also about continuing to have diversity on the list, and it's also about hiring practices at the board level, the staff level, and the National Council level. And we also started something called the Citizen Literary Fellowship, whereby somebody comes in for 10 months and they work 3 days a week and it's paid and it's apprenticeship, and it's supposed to, in this is only one place, but it's a step to connect with somebody who might not otherwise be able to afford an internship or something. And
right.
So we started that, and we've, our third fellow is with us now, and our second fellow came from Oakland, from a bookstore, and is back at the bookstore. And the first one is hired.
Oh, wow, great.
Yes, it's now, he came back to us when an opening came up, and is hired working on the poetry list.
Oh, wonderful.
With alongside senior editor Jeff Schatz, and he's been terrific.
Yeah.
And he had tried to, he was in New York at one point, and he had tried to get an internship, but he really, the financial resources weren't there, and he'd sort of given up and was working outside of publishing, and then he saw the ad and he came. And then when that opening came up, we interviewed a number of people, but we knew him and he knew us. And that's who we knew because we had done that in the past.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe we turned to people who we knew and they were the white interns who could afford it.
Right.
So it's just making some of those little changes can have ripple effects.
And being cognizant and not just sort of doing what you did last year or
that's right.
Historically.
That's right.
Now, I have interviewed a number of Grey Wolf authors, and I have a question about this, but I'll just tell you who. I don't think this is probably comprehensive, but I was thinking about it this morning. So I've interviewed Ben Percy, J. Robert Lennon, Angela Palm, Catherine Davis, Eula Biss, Robert Boswell. I'm sure there are others as well. And the thing I always notice when I interview a Grey Wolf author is I always learn something. And, you know, the craft of writing really comes through in those interviews. And so I just wonder if you feel like their ability to express their approach to craft, if that's a natural outcome of being a certain kind of writer.
You mean that they're able to be so articulate about craft?
Yes, exactly.
A lot of our prose writers... Eula Biss is an example.
She's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Have written poetry.
Yes.
One way or another, or very engaged with poetry. You know, Catherine Davis is.
Yes.
So I do think, as part of that definition of singular that I mentioned earlier, we're absolutely looking for writers who by the way they use it, you can see they're thinking about language and the powers of language and what language can do. And we've published some writers on craft. So we've published Robert Boswell's book about writing. We published Charles Baxter on writing. And those have been a nice little sort of successful subset of our list. So I think that is very deliberate. And sometimes when I'm rejecting something, I say I was hungry for a little bit more invention or innovation or adventure at the language level. Want prose that's working a little bit harder than and then.
Right. And actually, in the new book, Just Us, I know that that is actually a collection of not just essays, but poems and also images.
That's right.
So that's really interesting how all of that must come together.
That's right. And yes. And Citizen was a very high percent of poetry in that, and it was sort of classified as a poetry book and won some poetry awards. There was some grumbling about that, but in the main, I think people could see that that's where the source of the book was poetry.
Yeah. Now, Fiona, I'm wondering if we can talk about how Grey Wolf is supported. And also, I'm just curious, do big publishers ever come forward and try to buy the press or somehow take the press on as one of their imprints?
No. We have a very collegial relationship with Farrar Straus, who distribute us. So we're distributed through Farrar Straus / Macmillan, and that's been the case since 2002.
Okay.
But legally, you can't buy us because we're non-profits. There's no one to buy us from. There's no one who can sell it to you, which is nice. And I think that when you look at some for-profit, independent, smaller imprints, you see how ultimately they get bought. But the non-profit ones staying around for a longer time, the ones that have longevity, it's partly because no one can buy them or will buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of our sort of security long-term, I think.
Okay.
The board isn't going to sort of wake up one morning and find that I've done a deal with HarperCollins and lined my own pockets, for example. It's not legally possible, or the founder couldn't have done that, which was tough on him because he founded it and doesn't get to sell it on to somebody. That's a really nice thing about the structure.
Yeah. And how is the press supported? It's a non-profit.
Yeah. We have some support from foundations,
okay,
which has waned to a certain extent in recent years from when I arrived, which I think is a slight shame. But we have the McKnight Foundation locally has been very generous year in, year out. Target Foundation has been very generous over the years and was previously a Dayton Hudson Foundation and from the store Dayton that was locally. And the man who owned those stores, he got a lot of philanthropy going in the Twin Cities. But I don't know that everybody knows that Target actually is headquartered here in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
So that's been very good. They may be changing slightly away from the arts, but this year we still got some support from them. The Minnesota State Arts Board is a terrific supporter, and then the National Endowment for the Arts and the Lannan Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Those are our main foundations, and those are grants that you apply to, and there's a timetable, and when it's time to put in the grant, and it's relatively, in its own way, it's relatively efficient. And then supplementing that is something that's ballooned since I came over the years, part because of necessity, is a support from individuals,
mm-hmm,
which can be very inefficient because it's no one's job to give you money. So you can chase someone for 2 years and you might end up with $200, and yet someone who you haven't met could write you a check and $6,000 arrives on a Tuesday morning. You think, ooh, what? Why? But nevertheless, as in all of life, sustained effort does pay off over time. And we have a generous board, and they they donate to us, our national council, which is a sort of subsidiary second circle around that main inner circle of board members. They've right. been very generous. And the thinking behind that was locally, people support places that are very visible. They like to support the art gallery or the museum or the theater, and we're more invisible. And I could see that by the time somebody got to their seventh best friend locally on the board, that person didn't even read books. Right. And you could not persuade them to give. However, if you moved on to a different state, you know, wherever in the country, there we have activity. There are books in the library, books in the bookstore, possibly authors coming through. So it just made sense that we had a national basis of support. So that's been an exciting thing to grow. So yeah. they help us. There's something called the Galley Club now where you can sign up for, I think it's $180 a year, and you get six mailings from Grey Wolf during the year, five or six, and little tchotchkes and early galleys and that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. support that way. So that's been a really considerable source of support. And we've had a number of large campaigns, which have been mainly funded by individuals. We had a $1 million campaign, I think ended in 2006, and then a $2 million one that ended in 2014. And then we're in the middle of a $3 million campaign right now. And those have funded, they've been like creative investment funds, if you like. The money's gone to growing the list, making us stronger as publishers. This most recent one that's a little higher than the others has a little bit more infrastructure in it. But some nonprofits have an endowment, which is a sort of fixed amount of money in the bank that you draw on a percent of it every year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas we felt it would be so hard for us to raise a significant amount of money that to stick it in the bank and not be able to use it would be sort of killingly depressing sure. and debilitating. But to put it into books and then have the books reprint and sell, like the books are a sort of living, active library / endowment, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So something like Citizen selling, continually selling, or Maggie Nelson selling, but some of these nonfiction prize winners, these poets selling,
right?
That means more because you're actually getting your books out into the world rather than dollars sitting into the bank. We may yet visit the E word, but so far each of those campaigns has paid off in a certain way, or in a real way,
okay.
and sort of put the list forwards, and now the earned revenue is slightly higher than the contributed was maybe 5, 6, 8 years ago. It was the other way around, and the sales are always going to be along in a certain kind of sawtooth, and who knows how the pandemic's going to affect everybody.
Right.
But it's a nice for a press of our size. I think it's a nice discipline to have this sort of nonprofit aspect, because it makes you have the broadest possible approach. It allows you to assess a manuscript or a book's impact, not just in financial terms, but to be able to think about and articulate the cultural impact that a book is having. It gives you this stabilizing group of people around you in terms of the board, the National Council, who sort of care about you in a way.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's sort of an invisible enterprise. And there's a kind of discipline on someone like me is answerable to the board. You're not a sort of maverick going out on your own. And you have a sort of duty to report in. And just to be able to think about how important a book is going to be at the acquisitions period, and know that you've got this stabilizing,
you've got
contributed revenue coming in.
Yeah.
So I always feel like you can't we will have to share at Grey Wolf the credits that anybody gives us for being bold and taking risks. We are able to do that because of this support. We couldn't do it otherwise. So it's not just us by ourselves being super brave. Our bravery is underpinned by generous contributions.
Yes.
So it's those people who should take the credit for some of the risks that we take.
That's great. For my last question, I always like to ask for a little bit of advice for authors, because a lot of listeners are writers. And in your case, I thought I might ask you, because of your role throughout your work as an editor, I wondered if you have advice for authors as they look to revise and edit their own books before submission time. What advice might you have?
I would just say to take it as far as you can and then one notch further by yourself and get trusted friends to read it. Because if you think it's at 90%, maybe it's 80% or 75%, and that it's very hard for an editor or an agent to read something again after it's been revised.
Yes, yes.
So I would say it's not hard and fast, absolute, but I would say in general, you have one shot to impress the agent or the mm-hmm. Editor. But I also think, from our point of view, going back to this word singular that I come back to, I am more interested in talent and flashes of brilliance than I am with sort of mediocre competence, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. I would encourage the ambition and to take some risks and go for the accentuate the elements of the aspect that are most particular to you, rather than thinking that you need to sound like somebody else. But the more unlike other people you sound, the better. Not to have your revision be a process of evening and making yourself sound, but the revision being more a process of, I'm waving my hands all over the place, but sort of making my hands go out, or push the manuscript out as far as it can go, I would say.
Yeah, great. Before we finish, I just want to mention again, I've been speaking with Fiona McCrae, director and publisher of Grey Wolf Press, which is based in Minneapolis and is all over the world. But Fiona, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for all your good questions.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Fiona McCrae, director and publisher of Grey Wolf Press. You can learn more about her work at greywolfpress.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Fiona McCrae. Consider the Black Lives Matter movement and the murder of George Floyd. And write. Maybe write from the perspective of someone with different or more extreme opinions than your own. Or write from two distinct perspectives. Or perhaps write from the point of view of someone who has one opinion but is somehow personally affected by the movement in a way that amplifies, changes, or even negates that opinion. In responding to this current moment in history, consider your goal to be one of inspiring, meaningful dialogue. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Each week, I say the same thing. I hope that however isolated you are during the summer of 2020, you are able to read and to write. And if possible, I hope you are able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And for all of you who are trying to write these days, be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode does offer a writing prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. This is really important. I say it every week, but I like to highlight it every once in a while. If you like the show, please do rate it on iTunes and on social media and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.